The Katra Podcast, conversations for the curious essential knowledge, simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI. Welcome, curious minds, to another deep dive. Today, we are jumping into a really significant book.
We are indeed. It's Milton Friedman's 1962 classic, Capitalism and Freedom.
A book that truly shook things up, didn't it? Talking about money, markets, and, well, freedom itself.
Absolutely. And it's so much more than just economics. It's really a philosophical argument, a kind of manifesto for classical liberalism that's had, you know, a huge impact on politics for decades.
Right. And you have to remember the context. When he published this, the sort of accepted wisdom was very different.
Totally different. People generally believed in more government, central planning, the welfare state, Keynesian ideas. The thought was government had to step in, manage the economy.
And Friedman just fundamentally disagreed with that entire approach.
He did. He challenged it head on.
So our mission today is to really unpack his main point, which is pretty bold, that economic freedom isn't just nice to have. It's absolutely essential for political freedom.
Yeah, make you ask that tough question. Can you actually be free politically if the government has its hands all over your economic life?
To get why that was such a big deal, maybe we should talk about Friedman himself. Who was this guy?
Milton Friedman lived from 1912 to 2006, and he wasn't just some armchair theorist. He was a giant in economics.
Nobel Prize winner, right?
Yep, 1976, and a key figure in the Chicago School of Economics. Very influential. Crucially, his ideas weren't just abstract. They were based on serious empirical research.
That research part is important, isn't it? Like his work on the Great Depression.
Exactly. That was groundbreaking. He and Anna Schwartz showed pretty convincingly that the Depression wasn't like capitalism inevitably failing.
But more about mistakes made by the government.
Specifically, the Federal Reserve. Their policy errors made a downturn into a catastrophe. That finding really undercut the whole argument that markets are inherently unstable and need constant government tinkering.
Okay, so you had the academic chops.
Definitely. But he was also a brilliant communicator. He could take these complex economic ideas and translate them for, you know, regular people. Books like Capitalism and Freedom did just that.
He was really pushing back against the tide at the time.
He was. A very articulate voice arguing against that post-war consensus that favored bigger government. He turned economic theory into a powerful case for individual liberty.
So, given that history of challenging big institutions like the Fed, it makes sense that decentralizing power was key for him.
Yeah.
What's the absolute core idea of capitalism and freedom?
It's actually pretty straightforward, but profound. Economic freedom and political freedom, they're linked indivisibly.
Two sides of the same coin. Kind of.
Exactly. And because of that, he argued government's role has to be strictly limited. He used the analogy of an umpire.
An umpire, not a player. Okay, so what does the umpire do in his view?
The umpire's job is basically to protect freedom from coercion. That means enforcing contracts fairly, defining and protecting property rights, things like that.
What else?
Maintaining a stable monetary framework that was huge for him, given his work on the Fed. And he did acknowledge a role in dealing with what he called neighborhood effects.
Which we now call externalities.
Right. Externalities, like pollution, for example.
So if a factory pollutes the air, that affects people who weren't part of the factory's transaction with its customers.
Precisely. Friedman conceded that the government might need to step in there because costs are being imposed on third parties.
But beyond those limited functions.
Beyond that, he argued, government intervention, even with the best intentions, tends to erode liberty. Why? Because it concentrates power in the hands of the state.
And the book isn't just complaining, right? It offers alternatives.
Yeah, it's like a blueprint. It systematically suggests ways to replace government control with market-based solutions. Which brings us neatly to some of his specific policy proposals.
Okay, let's dig in. Where should we start? Maybe that foundational link between economics and politics.
Good place to start. Chapter one, really. Why is having a free market essential for, say, basic political rights, like free speech?
Friedman's argument is that economic freedom works as a check, a counterweight to political power. Think about it. If the government controls everything, all the jobs, the housing, the food.
Like in a totalitarian state.
Exactly. What happens if you disagree with the government, if you speak out?
Well, the state can just cut you off, deny you a job, maybe worse. They can literally starve dissenters into silence because they control your economic survival.
So economic control becomes political control.
Right. And the beauty of the market, for Friedman, is that it disperses that power. It decentralizes it. Well, if one employer doesn't like your politics and fires you, in a free market, there are hopefully thousands of other potential employers. The market creates this separate sphere of life, independent of the government.
So you're not totally dependent on the state. Your economic life isn't entirely in their hands.
Precisely. It gives you breathing room, a way to survive even if you dissent. That's the crucial check and balance.
Okay, that principle seems to underpin a lot of his more specific ideas. Let's talk about education. That's a big one he tackled.
Huge. Chapter 6. And it's a great example of his thinking. He actually supported government financing of education.
Why? If he's generally for limited government.
Because of that neighborhood effect again.
Mm-hmm.
He believed an educated population benefits everyone in society, not just the students and their parents. So public funding makes sense.
But, and there's always a but with freedmen and government roles.
Right. But he strongly opposed government provision, the government actually running the schools itself.
Why the decision?
He saw government-run schools as an inefficient monopoly. Like any monopoly, it lacks competition, so there's little pressure to improve quality, innovate, or cater to the diverse needs of different students and parents.
And his alternative was?
The famous, or maybe infamous, depending on your view, voucher proposal.
Okay, explain how that would work.
The idea is simple. The government gives parents a voucher, a fixed sum of money, for each child.
And they can use that voucher.
At any approved school, they choose public, private, religious, whatever. The money follows the child.
So schools have to compete for students and therefore for those voucher funds.
Exactly. It introduces competition. It empowers parents, turning them into consumers demanding quality. And it forces schools, public and private, to up their game to attract families.
Interesting. Okay, let's shift gears. What about helping the poor? Welfare systems.
Another area where he had a radical, market-oriented solution. He was very critical of the complex bureaucratic welfare systems that existed. He thought they were paternalistic, inefficient, and often trapped people in dependency, discouraging work.
So what was his alternative? Did he just say, let the market handle it?
No, not entirely. He proposed something quite specific. The negative income tax, or NIT.
Negative income tax, how does that work?
It's basically a way to guarantee a minimum income floor through the tax system. If your income falls below a certain level, you don't pay taxes. Instead, the government pays you.
So a direct cash payment.
A direct, no strings attached cash benefit. It would replace that whole confusing patchwork of programs, food stamps, housing subsidies, etc., with one simple, efficient mechanism.
And why did he see that as market friendly?
Because, designed correctly, it preserves the incentive to work. As you earn more income, the negative tax payment gradually phases out. But you always end up better off financially by working more. It avoids the sharp cutoffs or welfare cliffs found in some other systems.
So it provides a safety net without, in his view, creating perverse incentives.
That was the goal. A dignified way to help the poor that leverages the existing tax infrastructure.
Now we have to tackle one of the most, let's say, controversial arguments in the book, discrimination.
Chapter 7. Yeah, this one definitely raises eyebrows, especially today.
He argues that competitive markets are actually the best way to fight discrimination. That sounds counterintuitive. Many people assume we need laws and regulations to force non-discrimination.
Right. Friedman's argument comes purely from an economic perspective. He says, look, discrimination, refusing to hire someone qualified because of their race, religion, gender, whatever, is costly for the person doing the discriminating.
Costly how?
If you're an employer and you refuse to hire the best person for the job simply because you're prejudiced against their group, you're hurting your own bottom line.
How so?
You're settling for a less qualified worker, or maybe paying more for someone equally qualified. You're sacrificing potential productivity, innovation, profit.
All your competitor.
Your competitor, who doesn't discriminate and just hires the best person, regardless of group identity, gets an edge. They'll be more efficient, more profitable.
And over time, in a competitive market,
the non-discriminating businesses will tend to thrive, and the prejudiced ones will either have to change their ways or risk being driven out of business. The market itself penalizes prejudice.
So the relentless, impersonal pursuit of profit actually works against discrimination in his view.
That's the argument. It forces people, eventually, to focus on merit rather than irrelevant characteristics, because it pays to do so.
It's definitely a challenging perspective, and this skepticism of government intervention also applies to monopolies, right? And things like professional licenses.
Absolutely. Yeah. Chapter 9. He argues that most harmful monopolies aren't natural outcomes of capitalism.
That are created by?
By government action,
yeah.
Special privileges, regulations, barriers to entry, and particularly occupational licensure.
Things like needing a license to be a doctor, a lawyer, maybe even a barber.
Exactly. He was highly critical of these systems. He called them modern-day guild systems.
Guilds, like in the Middle Ages.
Yeah. He argued that these licensing boards, often dominated by people already in the profession.
Like the American Medical Association, the AMA, which he often cited.
Precisely. He argued they use licensing requirements not primarily to protect the public, but to restrict the number of people who can enter the profession.
To limit the supply.
To limit supply, reduce competition, and therefore keep prices and incomes higher for those already inside the guild.
So what looks like consumer protection is actually, in his view, more like a cartel trying to keep newcomers out.
That's his critique. He wasn't against standards, but he favored voluntary certification over mandatory licensing.
What's the difference?
Certification means a private group or association sets standards, and professionals can choose to meet them and get certified. Consumers can then choose if they value that certification. But it doesn't legally forbid anyone else from offering the service.
Whereas licensing does forbid practice without the state's permission.
Right. Licensing is a government-enforced barrier to entry. Certification is informational.
Okay, looking across these different areas, education, welfare, discrimination, licensing, you can really see some unifying themes emerging.
Definitely. And they're just as relevant today, maybe even more so.
What's theme number one?
It has to be the indivisibility of freedom. We touched on this. You simply cannot separate economic liberty from political liberty, in his view.
The ability to control your own resources, your own labor.
It's fundamental. If the government controls your economic choices, where you work, what you buy, how you save, then your political freedoms, like speech or assembly, become much harder to exercise effectively. They become hollow.
Okay, theme two.
I'd say the superiority of voluntary exchange. This is almost the moral core of his defense of markets.
Oh, so?
Think about a market transaction. I buy something from you. It only happens if I value the thing more than the money, and you value the money more than the thing.
Right. Both sides expect to benefit. Otherwise, the exchange doesn't happen.
Exactly. It's based on mutual consent and mutual benefit. Contrast that with government action, which ultimately relies on coercion.
Right.
Taxes, regulations, mandates, you comply whether you agree or not.
So markets coordinate activity peacefully through voluntary agreement, while government relies on force.
That's the fundamental difference he highlights.
And a third key theme.
This one is crucial for how we think about solving problems. The constant danger of unintended consequences and, well, government failure.
Meaning we shouldn't automatically assume government intervention is the best fix.
Precisely. Friedman constantly challenged that reflex. He urged people to look beyond the stated intentions of a policy and examine its actual, often hidden, long-term effects.
Can you give an example?
The minimum wage is a classic Friedman example. The intention is clearly good, help low-income workers earn more.
But Friedman argued.
He argued the unintended consequence is that it prices some low-skilled workers out of the market entirely. If the minimum wage is set higher than the value a worker can produce for an employer,
it becomes illegal for the employer to hire them.
Right. Leading to unemployment, particularly among the least experienced, least skilled workers, the very people the law was supposed to help. That's the kind of analysis he applied relentlessly.
These themes really come through in some of the memorable lines from the book, too. It's quite quotable.
It really is. He had a knack for crystallizing complex ideas.
Okay, let's pick out a few key ones. How about this? A society that puts equality ahead of freedom will end up with neither equality nor freedom.
That's a powerful one. It gets right at his critique of trying to enforce equality of outcome through government power.
What's the logic there?
To force everyone into the same material condition, you'd need an immense amount of centralized control over people's lives. That process itself destroys individual liberty, and he argued such systems historically haven't even achieved genuine equality anyway. They just create a new elite with power.
Okay, another one, focusing on the market itself. The most important single central fact about a free market is that no exchange takes place unless both parties benefit.
Yeah, that highlights what he saw as the moral basis of capitalism. It's not based on exploitation, in his ideal view, but on voluntary, mutually advantageous cooperation.
It frames the market as fundamentally about positive-sum interactions.
Exactly. Unlike zero-sum or negative-sum interactions driven by coercion.
And one more, maybe about progress and innovation. The great advances of civilization have never come from centralized government.
Mm. That's a direct challenge to the idea of top-down planning. He believed real progress, breakthroughs, new ideas, they bubble up from individuals, from entrepreneurs, from decentralized experimentation, and frankly, trial and error.
Not from committees or bureaucracies trying to design the future.
Right. Innovation requires freedom, risk-taking, diversity of thought, things that centralized systems tend to stifle.
So taking all this together, how can listeners, you know, apply these ideas in their own lives or when thinking about the world today?
Well, one direct application is just as a framework for analyzing public policy. When you hear about a new law or regulation, you can ask those Friedman-esque questions like, does this policy expand individual choice or does it restrict it? Who really benefits? And crucially, what might be the unseen long-term consequences that aren't immediately obvious?
It encourages a kind of critical thinking about government action.
Definitely. A healthy skepticism, perhaps. Another area is personal finance and self-reliance.
How so?
Friedman was famously critical of mandatory government-run programs like Social Security. His view was that compelling people to participate removes their freedom to choose how they save and invest for their own future.
And he probably argued the returns weren't great either.
Often, yes, because there's no competition. So his philosophy encourages taking personal responsibility, saving, investing privately, rather than relying solely on government promises, which can change.
Okay. And for people involved in business?
The book offers a strong moral justification for pursuing profit, but within a competitive framework.
How is seeking profit moral?
Because in a truly competitive market, the only way to consistently make profits long-term is by figuring out what consumers actually want and finding efficient ways to provide it. You have to create real value.
So the profit motive, channeled by competition, actually drives innovation and efficiency that benefits society as a whole.
That's the idea. It aligns self-interest with the public good, in his view.
So reflecting on the whole book, what's the biggest takeaway for you? What really stands out?
For me, it's the sheer intellectual consistency. Everything flows from that core principle. Valuing voluntary cooperation and being deeply skeptical of concentrated power, especially state power. Whether he's talking schools or money supply or discrimination, it all comes back to that fundamental choice between voluntary exchange and coercion.
Yeah, that consistency is striking. What surprised me most, or maybe challenged my assumptions the most, was that economic argument about discrimination.
That the market itself can be a force against prejudice.
Right. It's such a counterintuitive idea in today's climate, where the default assumption is often that regulation is the only answer. It really forces you to think differently about the mechanisms of social change.
It definitely does. It prompts you to look for the economic incentives and disincentives at play.
So I guess the final thought is maybe about vigilance, a need to constantly question the expansion of government power, even when it's proposed with the best intentions, because of those potential unintended consequences for freedom.
I think that's fair. The ultimate lesson seems to be that deep skepticism of centralized authority and a profound appreciation for what emerges when individuals are free to choose and cooperate voluntarily. It really forces us to examine the systems around us, healthcare, tech, finance, and ask, are these based on choice or compulsion? And who benefits from the status quo?
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Katra Foundation.